The following podcast is provided to you free, as is all our content, at drhoffman.com. If you'd like to listen, help support Intelligent Medicine, and get great values by shopping at our supplement store, go to drhoffman.com and click on Shop, then click on the store. Thanks, and enjoy the podcast. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and it is time once again for Q&A with Layla. Layla Mutin is Hoffman Center nutritionist. She and I work together with patients, seeing patients in conjunction with one another on a daily basis. Also, she has her own practice within the Hoffman Center, where she sees nutritional patients, we have a lively dialogue about health issues on a daily basis, and today is no exception. But we're going to do it for your benefit on the air, and we're going to field your questions. And once again, the way to get us questions is radioprogram@AOL.com. Please make your question concise and of general interest to our listening audience. Layla Mutin is a registered dietitian, and she holds a master's degree in the field of nutrition. So, how are you doing today, Layla?
Okay, how are you doing?
Okay, it seems just a couple of months ago that we were complaining about the cold.
now, I still have post-traumatic stress from this winter.
So you still,
I don't know about anyone else.
So you're still absorbing the heat. It feels good.
Yes. Okay. I don't mind the heat at all, actually. I'm a summer person, more than anything.
90-degree day here in New York, but it feels good after this last winter.
It sure does.
A lot of us are still thawing out.
Yep.
All right. So, interesting week in the world of nutrition. The cover of Time magazine has a picture of, it's a stylized picture of butter. And it's devoted to the theme of, now we've learned that saturated fat is not only okay for us, it's good for us. And
It's necessary for life. Yeah.
Right. And it's actually, this is interesting because this is the very same week that on a different podcast this week, if you check out our podcast page, I've interviewed Nina Teichholz, who's author of A Big Fat Surprise. And she's written an entire book, which has gotten a lot of attention and has spawned a whole reexamination of the diet debate, from the perspective that we took a big wrong turn when we recommended that people go on low-fat diets. But, you know, when I did a little research, when I saw that cover of Time magazine, I said, let me go through the historical archives of Time magazine, because I'm sure that they've been on both sides of this equation in the past couple of decades. So I went back. I've actually posted links to cover stories in Time magazine that say variously I think it was 1989, they said, oh, let's reconsider the low-fat diet. Maybe fat's good for you. That was 1989.
Wow.
And then, they have this whole thing, that this virtual jihad that they conducted against fat. You know, cholesterol's bad, statin drugs are necessary for all Americans, great breakthrough, what an innovation. We're going to save lives. That was the theme of the 1970s and 80s. And I posted some of those on my Facebook page. I think you'll find that amusing if you're listening.
Mm.
So, clearly, we've been around the block, and diet vogues come and go. But this whole, fat is okay thing, this is not new. This is something that, we act as if it's new.
It takes a long time to be accepted. That's really what it is. I mean, what are the phases of, first is denial and all of that, and, oh, my God, mm-hmm. that can't be right, and next
right.
is, oh, well, guess what? But it takes years, sometimes even decades.
Exactly.
Unfortunately, but at least it finally gets found out.
So, ultimately, I think we've fought this battle for a long time. I know you have, having worked at Dr. Atkins' office when he was still alive. And, to some extent, we feel personally vindicated by some of the evidence that's coming out about benefits of low-carb diets and the general okayness of high-protein diets. Although we're wary of the fact that much of the meat supply is poor quality when the dairy is not organic, when it's laced with bovine growth hormones, that's not good for you either. So
that's right. Well, you know, Dr. Hoffman, what I'm seeing a lot more, the trend that I'm seeing in a lot of restaurants, not necessarily here in Manhattan, but even in the outer boroughs, I live in Queens, you know, even the local diner is now saying, hey, we have grass-fed burgers, we have grass-fed steak, which is terrific.
That's an innovation.
You know, and we're getting more choices in the local key food, the Stop and Shop, the C-Town, all of that. You know, there are a lot more options now, which is really good. People are catching on. And the other thing is that people don't want to buy that factory farm meat anymore, you know. So I think they're starting to pay attention.
Right. You know, I think some of the stuff we've been talking about, and also some of the real strong voices in this field, you know, Dr. Mercola and Dr. Perlmutter, to some extent Dr. Oz, we've gotten the word out about you know, this controversy, and that, you know, really there are two sides of the argument, and that you know, we have to get past our previous biases against you know, fat.
Absolutely. So, yep.
By the way, a big week for Dr. Oz. I kind of feel sorry for him because
I do too.
Did you hear the story?
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, cause what happened is they invited him to testify before Congress. So he probably said, this is great because finally they're acknowledging me. This is going to be great. All the cameras are going to be on. He's a photogenic guy. He's really media savvy. And he's going to, you know, talk about the benefits of natural products. But also he was going to weigh in as an expert, you know, on, you know, what are the good products, what are the not so good products. And they ended up ambushing him. They attacked him from all sides because he promoted, well, you know, look, it's a mixed bag because, you know, I got to say, I'm very cautious about promoting weight loss products. You know that I am often offered endorsement opportunities and, you know, people ask me, you know, what's the next amazing fat burner? And we could actually do a lot of features and shows on, you know, fat burner this and, you know, amazing weight loss formula. People love that kind of stuff, but I have really steered clear of that, and I actually have it in my radio contract that I don't want any of that stuff on my show, even.
You know, terrific!
The magic weight loss formulas, because and once they made a mistake, they put I was outraged because they just kind of disregarded the contract, and they just slapped a bunch of, you know, sort of phony weight loss products on my program. And, you know, I had my my agent call him angrily on Monday and say, what are you doing? You know, this is, you know, and he really read them the riot act and said, okay, you know, we're not going to put ads for bogus weight loss products on Dr. Hoffman's show because I don't want to be identified with those things.
Good.
So, anyway.
And you know what? If people read the fine print on those supposed magic bullet weight loss products, they'd say way down at the bottom, in combination with a diet and exercise program.
Yep.
Hello. that's your bullet. That's your magic bullet.
Right. Results may vary, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. I mean, the products that, look, we think that there are accoutrements to dieting. I mean, if you're on a very skimpy diet, nutritional support is good because you may not be getting adequate nutrition. You need adequate nutrition to burn calories. It's not that vitamins will automatically burn calories, but nutritional support's important. Also, there is some plausibility to EGCG from green tea. It's a bit of a fat burner, but it's not something that's going to magically make you lose weight if you sit on the couch and eat junk.
That's similarly right. It does provide some nice metabolic enhancement, however.
Yeah, a little bit. And Capsaicin as well. We like that as a sort of a non spicy alternative to capsicum, which is red hot chili peppers. You know, if you eat enough red hot chili peppers, you will get a little bit of a metabolic effect, but it's totally unpleasant, and you'd be, you know, sweating through your clothes all day, and your face would be all red. So,
well, you know, you could listen to Red Hot Chili Peppers and dance a lot and sweating all day, and that's great too.
that definitely could work. That's probably the best way. But I'm talking about the Capsaicin Natura product that we use. It is a capsaicinoid, so it doesn't have that hot property. You know, again, look, I don't want to venture into the magic weight loss formula, but those are some of the things that we do think are beneficial. I'm not a big fan of Garcinia Cambogia, certainly not a big fan of raspberry ketones.
No.
Green coffee bean, I actually think there may be some science on that in terms of diabetes control, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to make you lose weight. magically.
Right,
but,
right.
You know, I mean, if you, frankly, if you take enough caffeine, you know, you're going to basically vibrate the weight loss. You know, you're just going to start.
Exactly.
It's like
and
taking
at the expense of your adrenal glands, too.
Right. Yeah, yeah, if you drink about, you know, 24 cups of green tea or, you know, 40 cups of green coffee bean extract, you know, like drinking like Red Bull, you'll completely lose your appetite and, you know, your blood pressure will go through the roof, your heart will palpitate, and you might lose some weight.
Yeah, and then you'll be completely fatigued and worn out and stressed.
Right.
From all the hormones that your adrenals are secreting and mugging you with, so yeah,
you'll be a wreck. All right, so there's so bottom line, there's no easy path. Dr. Oz, you know, hopefully in his appearance before Congress, it didn't taint the whole nutritional supplement industry. I think he was going to try and be a hero to the natural foods movement and the natural movement in general, but instead the message was, don't endorse supplements of speculative value, and you know, it's poor science, junk science, basically.
Yeah.
So anyway, we got a bunch of questions.
Yes, we do. We do. This first one is from Dennis. He writes, 10 years ago, when my son was 10 years old, he had Lyme disease and was treated with antibiotics for 10 days. He sometimes gets what he is told, Lyme arthritis, and is told to take anti-inflammatories and it goes away. My question is, this seems more like late Lyme. He has no other symptoms. And perhaps he needs a shot or another dose of doxycycline?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
Wow, and this is really, you've gotten here precisely the crux of the controversy over Lyme disease. And we did an excellent podcast, I believe it was last week, with Dr. Leo Galland, who is conducting a webinar series I recommend it very highly. I think the next one is going to be, you can catch it, it's on October 25th. His first one was on, I believe, you know, it was the 13th. And
his website is PillAdvise.
PillAdvise.com. Excellent website. And he's a brilliant doctor, and he has looked lately, he's turned his sights on Lyme disease, and he boiled it down into this kind of situation to four different possibilities. I think it was four. And he explained it this way. He said, if you are sick, if you feel poorly after supposedly good treatment for Lyme disease, correct treatment for Lyme disease, one of four possibilities exists. One is that we properly treated your Lyme disease, but you might be co-infected. You might be co-infected with, you know, when you get a tick bite, there's a possibility of many different organisms being transmitted. And the antibiotic protocol for Lyme disease doesn't cover all these possibilities like Bartonella, Anaplasma, Babesiosis. There are other diseases that you could have. So this is one of the pitfalls, is that we focus on Lyme disease, we don't focus on the other. So that's number one. Number two, what's his name, Dan?
His name is Dennis.
Dennis.
And this is about his son.
Yeah. What Dennis is saying might be true is that another possibility, and this is really controversial, is that for some people, just that initial 3 weeks of doxycycline or 6 weeks of doxycycline may not be enough. They may have resistant organisms that persist, that just stick around, and they got inadequate treatment. And so these are the people, and we see people who are getting intravenous antibiotics for months and months and months in an effort to eradicate Lyme disease. And the studies on this are equivocal. There are some people who say it's a miracle, it's great, thank God. And there are people who say, yeah, maybe I feel a little better when I get the antibiotic treatment, but it always comes back. The studies actually don't highly support that. Now, on an individual basis, some people may say this is a lifesaver. Thank God for the doctors who treat with very high doses of antibiotics. I personally don't. I don't go that route of treating with heavy-duty antibiotics. A third possibility is that after Lyme disease, you can develop an autoimmune disease. And that happens after, we know, for example, that after you have an Epstein-Barr infection, a sequel to that might be multiple sclerosis. You know, it's, you start your immune system churning with a virus, and then the virus is gone, but you start to have an immune system meltdown. And this actually may be the case for many types of conditions, conditions like ankylosing spondylitis. It may be triggered by a bacteria in the gastrointestinal tract. That's one theory. And there are many possibilities. Unfortunately, even by eradicating the bug that triggered the problem, the autoimmune problem persists. Okay, so that's another explanation. I think we're up to number four. Another way that there could be a persistence of symptoms is, let's say you kill the Lyme disease, but
spirochete,
but its fragments of it persist in your body. And this is one theory, is that because there are these antigenic fragments that persist in the body, that the body reacts as if there's a foreign invader. That's a little bit similar to the previous thing, which is the persistent autoimmune reaction. But, you know, the symptoms are identical. You feel malaise, you may feel joint pain, you may have all the symptoms of the original Lyme disease that persist for a long time. And the third possibility, this is now a fifth possibility, right? Actually, I said there were four. This fifth possibility is that you may be devastated by the treatment itself. The antibiotics themselves can cause you to have candida, dysbiosis, and this is actually
leaky gut.
Absolutely.
And that's the beginning of autoimmunity, too.
Yes, yes.
You have to consider that setting off the immune system, not just Lyme, possibly.
We see that with kids who receive too much treatment for acne, for example, with lots and lots of antibiotics, or people who've had too much treatment for sinusitis. Or men who've had too much treatment for prostatitis, they will experience a long-term malaise. And it's the antibiotics themselves that disrupt the balance intestinally, create an overgrowth of harmful bacteria and or yeast, and you're off to the races with challenging symptoms. And you have to restore the balance, get rid of the yeast, suppress the harmful bacteria. And so it's complicated. It is this whole deal of properly assessing whether people have Lyme disease, whether they deserve intensive treatment. And the problem is, okay, if you deliver the intensive treatment, you better be ready to accept the consequences of the intensive treatment, because antibiotics long-term are not that benign. And you may actually, you know, it's a risk-benefit equation. Should you be using very high doses of antibiotics long-term, thus engendering the risk of candida or dysbiosis, which further suppresses the immune system? And that's the question. A lot of open questions around Lyme disease.
What are the alternatives, though?
Well,
how else would you? Yeah.
Well, I mean, the alternatives are, in my opinion, I think people are both underdiagnosed and overdiagnosed for Lyme disease. I think sometimes, you know, in almost a state of desperation, patients with challenging and bizarre symptoms shop around, go to doctors. Eventually, they'll go to what is called a Lyme-literate doctor, a doctor who's oriented towards Lyme disease. And a doctor will say, well, yeah, you know, whatever, you know, your headaches, your joint pains, your malaise, your fatigue, your depression, your anxiety, that's Lyme disease. And then they'll say, yeah, but the tests aren't so positive. But you know, eventually, if you do enough tests, you'll find something that's sort of positive. And then they'll bomb away with antibiotics. That may be overtreatment in some cases. On the other hand, some people may go for years improperly diagnosed. And we've seen some patients where finally we say, well, it looks like we really need to address Lyme disease, and the treatment does benefit them.
Yeah.
However, I have not been uniformly impressed with high-dose antibiotics for these types of patients. I just, you know, I got to say, I have some reservations about that. You know, what are the alternatives? Well, you know, you can, I like to look at patients and say, hey, what else is wrong? Let's not blame everything on Lyme disease. Let's try and optimize. I wrote a book on Lyme disease many years ago with that in mind as sort of natural alternatives to high-dose antibiotics. And I still think that that holds true. And the best, even the doctors who use antibiotics skillfully recognize that you have to repair patients using a diet approach, a nutritional approach, just like any other disease.
Yeah. Okay. Best of luck to Dennis's son.
It's a dilemma. Sorry, Dennis. Yeah. It's a tough problem.
Yeah. Okay. Do we have time for another question?
Yes, go for it.
Great. This one comes from Kay in New Jersey. She writes, after a mastectomy for stage 1 breast cancer, the oncologist prescribed Arimidex for 5 years. I am 73. I did not like the long list of side effects. After being happy that the cancer was out of my body, lymph nodes clear, I had to hear about this pill.
Mm-hmm.
Question is, if I do not take the pill, is there an alternative way around this?
Okay. Yeah, this is something where, you know, I don't want to make a definitive offer a definitive opinion, because that's like offering a second opinion without having all the facts in front of me. But the in this case, she's got a localized breast cancer, and I don't know about the tissue pathology, but you know, it may not be very aggressive. The lymph nodes are negative, and she's 73, which is not it's an intermediate age. It's not, you know, very young where we want to have all the precautions in the world, but we're certainly at 73. We're looking forward to potentially 15, 20 years of additional life or more. So we're not going to just say, oh, well, you know, you're checking out anyway. So, you know, if the cancer comes back in a few years, you'll probably be dead anyway. So the Arimidex is sort of like an insurance policy. It's a hormone blocker that is somewhat effective at reducing the risk of cancer recurrence.
Which for a 73-year-old,
that's
a hormone blocker?
Well, that's no, but there still are hormones active even postmenopausally. So,
I see.
So it's
even a smaller amount of
So there, I mean, there's a rationale for it. However, I think the risks in terms of women who take Arimidex often really feel horrible. They feel horrible mood-wise. They sometimes feel achy. It's like they're completely shut off of hormones. And if you think there's no hormones going on when you're 73, just ask a person who at 73 starts taking Arimidex. They really notice a difference in how they feel. So there's very low levels of hormones that are produced, not zero, past menopause in women. And Arimidex actually blocks testosterone very specifically, and that could be a big deal. Blocking androgens for women can make them feel very poorly physically and mood-wise,
yeah.
And also it's got devastating effects on the bones, you know, and mm-hmm. So look, I've not infrequently I see women who are given this option of, you know, you can take Arimidex, that'll give you a greater chance of survival, and they decide, nah, you know, for what? The additional 5 or 10% reduced risk? Why undergo those horrible symptoms? And then we give them a very aggressive breast cancer prevention program. So
yes.
Why don't we talk about that in part two, okay? Because this is a good inflection point because, you know, for the question here is should I take Arimidex or not? In my mind, that's the less important question. The question is whether to undertake a very active program of prevention once the breast cancer has occurred, make sure that it doesn't reoccur in the same place or occur independently, a second primary in the opposite breast. Or, this, I think, is once you've got that warning shot fired over your bowel that you're at risk, what are some of the things to do? So we'll tackle that in part two of today's Q&A with Layla, prevention of breast cancer. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.